It's Song Talk Radio with Michael, Neil, Phil, and the gang.
Welcome back to the show, Song Talkerinians. We are so glad you could join us here on the show. So we talk about all the fidgety bits of songwriting with all sorts of folks each week, along with other stuff. And to help me with all this song talking are the members of Team Song Talk Power Rangers Go Team. Mr. Neil Modi, how are you doing, Neil?
Boarding for duty, sir. Doing well, thank you.
And Mr. Michael Proudfoot, how are things, Mr. Proudfoot?
Things are quite well. Nothing like sunshine to make you feel a bit better about the world.
Indeed. Yeah. So while we are song talking, you can send us your questions or comments or your insights on the show to feedback@songtalk.ca, and we'll try our best to respond to them possibly in the next show or so. And if you happen to be watching us on YouTube, why don't you click on the like and or subscribe button? And if you do that, that actually helps the show quite a bit by getting YouTube to recommend it to other folks who like all things talking and all things song. So that would be very nice. So to start off, Michael, you had a bit of music news.
Oh, yeah, just reading through the various internets, and I noticed a few things of interest. One thing, the Junos are coming up on CBC on June 6th, and the remaining members of the Tragically Hip are getting together with Feist to do a song, a Tragically Hip song. So I'm really interested in hearing that. So that will be great. Also in news, we're bemoaning the fact that it's been very hard to see live concerts. The Horseshoe is going to be doing a live drive-in concerts. They've booked, I think, the Sadies and the Stars, the Jim Cuddy Band. So that's coming in July.
What's the location for that? Because you can't drive in the Horseshoe.
I think it's the City View Drive-In. I'm not sure where that is. Is that the one that's down in Polson?
I do believe, yeah, we went for a drive-in movie there last summer, I think.
Down in the docks.
It's down the docks, yeah.
Down the docks. So, yeah, so they're going to be doing live shows. Let me see. It's a three-show series from the 15th to the 17th of July. Ooh. And who else? Yeah, so Jim Cuddy Band, Arc Sound, Stars, the Sky Diggers, the Sadies, who I really like, and Elliot Brood.
Nice.
So, and I thought I saw a few others that are coming to that venue. And, and you know, if you want to travel to Chicago, Lollapalooza is back on this summer.
Oh, so, really?
Seriously live music, and that is, let me see, Chicago's Grand Park from July 29th until August 1st.
Like a la crowds of people gathering to watch sort of thing?
I'm not sure. They're going to do a full lineup announcement tomorrow, very soon in May.
Okay. And then days after in Ontario, all events in the summer are canceled.
Everything is canceled.
Exactly. There's different ways to go about handling the pandemic.
If you're in Chicago, go bonkers. Yeah.
Some are healthier than others, in my opinion. So that's what's coming up. I'm very excited about seeing the Junos and seeing Feist and Tragically Hip together.
Yeah, that'll be interesting for sure.
I wanted to mention a fast little tip I picked up. My friends and I are doing a little book club, a songwriting book club, and maybe that's something we'll do here on the show. Mm-hmm. And it's a book by Jeff Tweedy of Wilco, and it's called How to Write One Song. And most of the first part is actually a lot of the stuff we talk about on the show about writing every day, that kind of thing. So it's really for people who have never written a song before. But one of the things that I really liked is he had a fast little exercise. So you take a subject, and his example was a doctor, and you just choose a subject out of, from random. And on the left-hand side of a page, you write down like 10 or 12 verbs associated with the doctor. So it could be thump, scan, prescribe, write. And then on the right side of the page, you write the equal number of words of the stuff you see actually in your room. And then what you do is you just draw lines between words that don't normally go together as a way of kind of getting your brain out of the habit of you know, we often use very similar word associations. Mm-hmm. And
sounds like a cliche breaker.
Yeah. And it was, I tried it. It was actually a lot of fun. So it's a, it's a fast little thing. And the book is called How to Write One Song by Jeff Tweedy. And it is quite, quite a neat little book. So you might want to pick that up.
That's certainly something we've never heard before. I've never heard of that, that kind of technique before. It's kind of cool.
Yeah, so I was quite happy that, you know, even though we've been doing this for 6 years, I learned something new, which is always a good thing.
Yeah, and that's the great thing about songwriting, music, art in general, is there's always something to learn.
Indeed. Mm-hmm. Anything from you today, Neil?
Yeah, just still hacking away at making some changes to my home studio. Finally got around to building a under-the-desk tray for my keyboard. For my new keyboard, which for the first time ever, I've reduced down to 49 keys. So I've only got a 4-octave keyboard. I was 61 before. Years ago, I had a 76 note keyboard because I thought, oh, I'm a real piano player, but it turns out I'm not. And I'm quite happily hacking away on four octaves, and it says perfectly fine because my desk is kind of limited. So I had to reduce the size, but the thing that I was playing around with it earlier today, and the biggest difference, which I fully anticipated, is because everything that I do is very software driven, and it's all the plugins I use are on the computer. This is a keyboard controller. It has no sounds built into it. It has to wire everything through the computer. So to be actually right in front of my screen with my keyboard at my fingertips is very handy for manipulating plugins and doing all that sort of thing. Whereas before, my keyboard was sort of off to the side, and I'd have to like reach over with the mouse or try to squint over to see what was going on the monitor if I needed something. So I'm hoping this will actually make my studio life a little bit more productive and a little bit more like I can just dive into it and just play around, you know, at a whim, as opposed to going over there and powering on the keyboard and, both, you know, setting all that.
We'll check in a month and see how much more productive you've been.
Yes,
that's true.
We'll find out.
And we have a listener email, and we love it when people write in, so please write in. It's a question from Carolyn T. Hi, guys. Your show is so great, easy, fun listening, while also super informative with lots of variety, and love the humor. Mm-hmm. My question stems from your May 17th show. You were talking about working on multiple songs simultaneously. Mm-hmm. And I have songs scattered in various stages on my laptop and phone, and yes, even on paper, very messy. My question is, when is the right stage of creation to register your song with your professional rights organization or performing rights organization? So in Canada, that would be SOCAN. The US, it'd be PRO. And also, when to register with your government copyright office? Thanks a bunch, Carolyn. So let's start with you, Michael. What do you think?
As long as you're still working on it at home before you take it out to play it, then you're fine. But as soon as you start playing it in venues that pay the royalties, then you might want to have something, you might want to have registered it by that point. It doesn't apply. I'm not sure how it works here, but I remember we had a guest who played a lot of open mics in the UK, and they were actually generating her some money that way, because she had registered her songs, and so the venue was also paying money in, and so she would make some money playing open mics. Don't think that happens here, but definitely before your music is going to go out to anywhere where you might be getting residuals or royalties from your music, you'd want to register it, I would think. Neil, what do you think?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would agree with that. I mean, when you're talking about rights, when you're talking about royalties, there are a couple of different ones. SOCAN handles the songwriting royalty. And then I forget what the one is for performance. So that if you do play at a show and you submit your set list and all that sort of stuff, and the venue submits their information to the organization, then you can get, you know, your couple of pennies from that. And you really should do that after your songs are recorded. So, because when you upload your information to SOCAN, you need the title and you need the length of the song. So if it's 3.5 minutes then in the recording, then that's what it is. Full disclaimer, we're not we're not here to give legal advice, but as far as copyright is concerned, my understanding is that the second you write a song, your song is copyrighted.
Right? You just have to be able to prove when and that you did it.
Right? If when the time comes that you need to prove that you are the songwriter for this song, if someone tries to steal your song or whatever, and you end up in court, then if you have documentation, if you have, you know, your printed lyric sheet that has a timestamp date on it and a digital file, you have a recording, you have the multi-tracks of all your recordings that you did and they're timestamped and it shows that you recorded the song long before that other person recorded theirs, then you've got some leeway. My understanding is you don't necessarily have to go to a governmental copyright organization to officially copyright your songs. It's kind of a given, at least in Canada and the US, that when you write it, it is essentially protected.
Yeah, right. Well, I'm hoping our next guest will kind of
if only we had a guest who could answer these sort of questions.
So the topic today is one that's been in my brain for a while now. And it's a phrase that I think we've all heard our whole lives, mm-hmm. and that is a record label. Oh, like he was picked up by a record label or they started a record label. But I realized, I have to admit, I don't actually precisely know exactly what a record label is. And I don't precisely know what a record label does. So to help with that, we have our next guest. Let me get a script back here. We have our next guest who has kindly agreed to come on to the show to clear all this up. Jeff Kulik is the president of Linus Entertainment, which went from a startup label to become one of Canada's most successful independent music companies. He has successfully sourced, negotiated, and closed on asset purchases of 12 prominent label and publishing catalogs, the most recent, the closing on January 1st, 2021, of the Borealis Records and Publishing Catalog, with over 100 albums of sound recordings and compositions, including the catalog of iconic singer and songwriter Stan Rogers, and Sony Plain Records, and the publishing catalog of over 100 albums, including music of Ian Tyson, Blues Hall of Fame artists Ronnie Earl, Sue Folio, Long Chong Baldry, and others. Thank you so much for coming on the show, Jeff.
Thank you for having me, guys. Good to be here.
So, just what is a label? I don't actually know.
Oh, okay. Well, a label is the entity or the company or the partners or the people that artists entrust with helping finance their careers through advances, helping them record music, helping them market the music, distribute the music, create revenue from the music so that the artist actually sees proceeds from their work, right? So that's the recorded music side. That's what a label does. Artists, perform live as well, and that's a whole other sector, live performance. That's a different side of the music sector. Sound recording, music recording, label is the label's business, and the label or the record company are people that invest in producing sound recordings, securing a stake in them, administering the proceeds, and taking on the obligation of paying the artist and the songwriters their royalties due for creating the works under the terms that have been worked out.
So when you go on tour, then you're dealing with a whole different other group of people.
Yeah. I don't do tours. Our company is, it's not unique in this way, but we're not an artist management company or a booking agency. We get involved in a very limited way, in live performance, only where we actually own the brand. So we produce concerts by the Mozart Effect Orchestra, which is all classical music, all Mozart's music with, audio visual presentation, large screen with, big lighting and stuff like that. So that's the only live performance area that we get into, but it's related to a brand. You know, a lot of, you know, artists don't like to think themselves as brands, and I would never call one a brand. Other people do, but, you know, we have story, classical kids stories, the Mozart effect, and different ways of marketing music that, you know, often, you know, go alongside the artist names.
So this sounds like an obvious question, but again, I just want to make sure. So when people say a record company and a record label, are they the same thing?
Pretty much, yeah. Yeah. Oh, okay. I don't see any distinction between them, right? They're the producing, marketing, production, exploiting, distributing sound recordings.
Now, people have mentioned, that, you know, this band, they started their own label. And I never actually understood what that meant. Like, when someone says they start their own label, what does that mean?
Well, I think it really means that they want to manage the distribution and marketing of the sound recordings themselves. And every artist has, you know, that innate right to do that. It's their creative property, their you know, their creations. They can choose how to bring them to market. And a lot of artists, you know, really feel that the best way to do that is independently. And I say more power to them, you know, learn the skills that we have. And as a label, you know, I always tell artists that, you know, if you're already successful, I think it's a smart move, you know, to retain, you know, some of your copyrights. But often when you're new and starting out, you need investors. You need people that can help you, you know, bring your music to the world. And labels are one of the, you know, highest risk-taking group of entrepreneurs. Like, we're not trying to take advantage of artists. We're like the best banker you ever, you know, could find, because, you know, we are true entrepreneurs. We risk our funds on highly speculative, you know, music. Mm-hmm. And it's a gamble. It's fun. I love doing it. But we're like the friendly investors that can help bring your music to the world. And we don't work for free, right? Nobody does, right? We don't want artists to work for free either. The thing that pisses me off the most is, like, you know, TV production companies saying, hey, give us your music for free and we'll give you exposure.
Exposure. Well,
the grip gets paid, the actor gets paid, the administrator, the bookkeeper, everybody, you know, down the line gets paid, but they don't want the creative musician, music creator to get paid. So
for the, like, up and coming artists, is that really the main driver for them, is sort of capital investment in their career, essentially?
Well, that's one big reason to, you know, give up the copyright in your music sound recording or your music publishing, is because you need those investors. So right. When you're already successful, and you've given up maybe part of your catalog, and now you're free, because no contract forces you to give up your copyrights forever, everything you ever create. There's always a term and a, you know, the fixed to the titles that are under the agreement. So you've got a lot of, I'm losing my train of thought here. What am I trying to say? The artist really dictates what terms they want. When we sign a more established artist, like we've signed Buffy St. Marie and David Clayton Thomas and Matt Anderson, these are all artists that had, you know, big careers before we got involved with them. But they see the value in working with us on marketing and distribution, and because we have music publicists that we work with and record distributors, physical, digital relationships with Spotify and Apple Music, Amazon, all the places that music can get impressions and reach people. Those are the arrangements and relationships that we have, and that we, you know, through marketing advertising dollars, or whether it's just through, you know, being nice people and providing great content, you know, if it's great music, people are going to dig it. And then we try and, you know, get that heard by the most number of people possible.
Can you talk about the copyrights? So do the musicians, as part of the agreement, is it, do you take a percentage of the copyright, or how does that
work? Every deal is different. Yeah. See the sun shining behind me? This is how I present to artists. I go,
that's true.
I can grant you access to fame and fortune.
Three wishes.
You know, I
so like
up that
Gandalf sun. The White appeared in Lord of the Rings.
So I got connections, right? You see how I hooked up that sun for this shot?
That's good.
Yeah? Hey, keep doing that and go down slowly.
You can make the sun okay, like set.
Right. So
you can control the sun. You can do anything.
So anyway, that's the silliness that a lot of, you know, big labels and managers, they roll down the limos and the, you know, fancy this and that. And a lot of young artists are captured by that, you know, glamour and, you know, you gotta watch out for, you know, you make great business decisions and choose the people you want to work with and don't get caught up in, the celebrity thing, right? So I'm very uncelebrity. I'm not a hanger on. I don't like hanging out backstage. I don't want to invite artists over to my house for dinner or show up at their, you know, family affairs. I'm strictly business, but, you know, I believe in the artists that I work with, and I believe that they believe I'm looking out for their best interests on the sound recording side. So mm-hmm. Got a lot of great relationships with artists.
And how is business? Because the recording industry, like selling records and then selling CDs, used to be incredibly profitable. It doesn't seem to be that way anymore. And streaming and such like doesn't generate as much income. Has the industry changed drastically that way?
It's constantly evolving, and different areas go through ups and downs, different sectors. Right now, the live music business is getting killed, and, you know, thank God for the government supports that are out there. That's keeping them, alive and able to create, and they're all going to be coming back, and they're all recording, and there's going to be great music and great live experiences coming in the future. So, you know, the government of Canada and Ontario, mostly the government of Canada, has been pretty good about those supports. The live music side is particularly hard hit with COVID. On the sound recording and distribution side, not so much. Mm-hmm. There's been a real steep drop in physical sales because of retail stores closing. But there's been some digital growth, so we're not feeling the same kind of pain that the live music business is.
Right. Mm-hmm. And was there a significant drop in physical sales? Did streaming really make a big difference? Or
it's not like streaming killed physical sales. You know, physical sales was killed by culture and, you know, how, you know, we're evolving as a species with digital media communications and all those tools, right? It's like really the music business was the first, to feel the digital impact because of really file size.
Mm-hmm. Right.
That's it.
Good old MP3. So,
5 megs, audio, decent sounding, not amazing.
Mm-hmm.
Swap it. And boy, so that in the way that the music business is handled, it is that they've come out of it. And then now they're in a very strong position of growth on the sound recording side. So you see a lot of these deals happening on publishing and people buying out this and that. And people realize that music is a intellectual property asset is a valuable thing.
So how would you answer the question from our reader about, you know, she has a bunch of songs and she's wanting to know when she should register them with a performance rights organization and when to, I guess she's in the States because she actually wants to register them with a copyright office in the States, which I don't think exists in Canada, but maybe it does. Oh, does it?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you know, people need to, I think, do their own research and learn about, if they want to be a musician and a creator, there's lots of written research that they can do on the music business. There's colleges and universities that teach music business courses. Those kind of questions are answered through that thing. I don't want to go into the technical stuff because I'm drinking a glass of wine.
I was actually wondering about like artist integrity, right? Like every music biopic I've ever watched, and this may just be because we need a villain. The villains in those movies and those narratives is always the label, right? Oh, you guys sold out and the label's just interested in making money and they don't care for our art. And yeah, the double horns and all of it.
I don't hear a single.
Yeah, I mean, where's the next smash hit single?
Yeah, sometimes it's the manager, though. It's not always the label, often it's the label.
Yeah, but I mean, and of course, in drama, you need a villain. Otherwise, biopics will probably be pretty boring.
One thing's for sure. The reason why a record didn't happen or whatever is it's not because of the artist or that the record wasn't, amazing.
So it's just timing? Or?
I'm being sarcastic.
Okay. I'm wondering where the punch
is. It's a lighthearted shot at all the artists that might be listening right now. Yeah, right? Yeah. Hey, it's ego. They have their creations. They believe in them. They're babies, and they should be passionate about them, But it's hard to have a successful record, and there's a lot of great music that doesn't get heard. It sucks. I've invested in and been involved with a lot of great records that I just think are, amazing. And they still come into my playlist and I listen to them and I'm digging them. I think they were, world changing, but they didn't happen. And, I don't have the magic button to make stuff happen. I can try and, move the needle as much as I can as a label and a distributor and promoter and marketer. But, I can't make stuff happen as much as, I'd like to. Not even the biggest guys can make stuff happen. The major labels now, there's no real artist development happening at that level. They basically have a lot of analytics reading, what's spiking and what market streams and Shazams and everything else and all these daily analytics that, we have too. But the model that they're following is like when something starts racing, you just throw a ton of money at it and then you ride the gravy train, as Pink Floyd said. We can't afford to compete like that as a label. I don't have, $10 million, nor have I ever, as an A&R person, chased the buzz thing, what everybody else is going after. I like working with music that I like and artists that I like, and I'm a boutique label, and I get to choose who I want to work with. And, if I don't want to work with you, I don't want to work with you. It doesn't matter. You might have something going on.
Yeah. There's a lot of different
things. What advice would you get? Oh, sorry. Go ahead, Phil.
No, I was just saying that. So if someone signs with a label, what kind of, experience would they, I know that it's hard to be, specific, because it's such an open-ended question, but what kind of things would they be dealing with? Would you be helping them with their stage show or maybe their styling of the music, or what exactly does a label do for an artist?
Well, it's more about the money and the marketing, frankly, the A&R side, like, if an artist wants my opinion, I'm happy to give it. They sure know that. And I'll even offer it, without them asking, and they like that even less, clearly. But I'm really about selling their music, and I think at the end of the day, when they hear me talking, and they may think, "Oh, what the fuck is why is he messing with my tunes or whatever?" I'm really just interested in getting more people to hear it, right? So, there's a value in listening to what the people that are marketing your records are saying. If it doesn't, mess with you, your creative intent or what your process are, it's probably a smart thing to let the marketing people market the way they want to market. Yeah. Oh, yeah. If you want to get your music heard.
Yeah. That might be a big part of it, because like especially on like Facebook groups of home recording enthusiasts and even other artists I know who have small followings, they're always like, oh, well, I distributed my album on CD Baby or DistroKid or whatever, but that's distribution. That's totally missing the marketing piece, isn't it?
Yeah, there's not a lot of marketing there. And you know, those guys have built pretty amazing businesses by you know, basically, you know, being the FedEx of the music delivery business. You know, but there's issues with that too. You know, like for anybody now can upload anything, right? Mm-hmm. So I'm constantly fighting with people that are pirating our music now. They're ripping a live Bruce Coburn album or children's music Mozart Effect trademarked brand that is ours, and they're just pumping this music out there, and these distribution companies like TuneCore and DistroKid, they don't have any filter. They'll let pirate music and rip
really? Oh, I did not know that. I presume they had some kind of a system.
Yeah, it's a problem now. So wow, you know, I don't know what's going to happen, but there's something like 50,000 tracks a day being uploaded, and a large percentage of it is pirate, you know? So it sucks there. But I don't want to prevent artists from getting their music heard and making it available. I think that's great. But I don't know that just pushing everything into the search index on Spotify and Apple Music makes sense. I think they're starting to filter results now.
Yeah. I've heard of people uploading original songs that just have same titles as popular songs so that they
like total rips, right? Like soundalikes, you know, spelled almost identical to it, just to try and it's basically really just ripping off the original creators and producers. So
I wrote an article for a blog about soundalike tracks, and there's these services where, you know, if you wanted to have a Smiths track in your, you know, in the background of your movie, but you didn't want to pay for the Smiths track, you can get these, you can buy a track that basically sounds like the Smiths, but not by the Smiths, and it doesn't cost as much. And it was really bizarre, just kind of going, wow, this, because some of them are so close to it. It's like, this sounds like the Smiths, but.
Yeah. Well, there are companies that are doing that, and production music libraries, they're called, where they, you know, they just in the studio try and clone the sound. They'll do the song, you know, so the publisher might get paid and try and sound as much alike or do a variation. But there's some production music libraries that, you know, actually tag their music. You know, this sounds like, you know, the Bangles, you know. Our artists should really just be more concerned with that. I don't think enough artists are aware that their music is being diluted.
No, not at all.
I imagine, especially if it gets popular, then people will jump on your train.
Yeah, as soon as something's a hit, you know, the companies, they're immediately doing cover clones and, you know, production music clones. But you know what? Like, you know, it's a free market, right? So it's not against the law to do that. You know, it just might be culturally not very cool.
Yeah, you hope people want the real thing.
Right.
If an artist wanted to be signed by a label, what could they do to make themselves most attractive? Or what do you wish artists knew would make your job easier or better? Or, you know, is there something or some things that artists should be aware of that often they're not?
Well, artists, you know, if they're serious about what they're doing, they're going to find their own answers through learning and research. And I encourage them to read, you know, and watch documentaries and educational resources that are available to them on the music business and the creative process and what other people do. And, you know, quite frankly, the best teachers for artists are other artists. You know, they find a way to, you know, to connect with other artists, and that's really the best you know, guidance and learning is from other artists, not necessarily from guys like me or lawyers or managers.
Right. Do you have any sort of books or resources that you think are good off the top of your head?
Well, there's lots of music business books, and there's Canadian ones, international ones. I'm not going to recommend anything, you know, in particular, but, you know, I like reading biographies by record producers and record label people and, you know, some artists, you know, some artists, you know, have interesting perspectives. I love reading you know, books, biographies and autobiographies on music and music personalities, music business personalities, a lot of education there. And there's colleges, you know, like Harris in Toronto, Fanshawe College in London and Trebus. And, you know, there's places where you can actually learn through a curated educational program on different aspects of the music business. And if you're serious, then you're going to invest the time and figure out a way to find the resources to do that.
Yeah, we've had guests on the show from Ryerson University who are in the music program, and sure enough, they say that, yeah, half of it is music business, the other side is the creative stuff. Mm-hmm. But they do spend a lot more time, I guess, than they used to in post-secondary education on music business if you're going into the music stream.
Yeah, it's a growing sector. It's a you know, interesting space, and it's you know, working in culture is great. Like I can't see myself doing anything else. And, you know, I think it's something that here in North America and especially in Canada, we've got all these great diverse cultures and people with the freedom, financial freedom, healthcare and stuff like that to allow them to pursue more artistic paths. So mm-hmm. It's a hotbed.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's fascinating. Well, I think I have a bit more of an idea about what a label is. So mm-hmm. Never quite sure before precisely what they do. Now, how often do you sign fresh talent, like sort of new people? Is it just sort of when someone grabs your attention, or is it?
You must be actively seeking.
Yeah.
Well, I you know, rely on just a network of associates and friends and acquaintances in the music business, whether they're music critics or studio producer or engineers or, you know, radio station people, or, you know, there's a whole array of people that are music fans and do it for a living or just do it for a passion. And, you know, certain people will refer things to me, and certainly artists are the best referral. If, you know, I hear from one of my artists that they're a big fan, and, you know, they bring to my attention another artist, that's probably the best recommendation. And I'll check out the music, and if I like it and passionate about it, and I believe there's a business case for it, then, you know, I'll you know, propose something. And, you know, oftentimes, you know, it just doesn't work out because the artist has a different vision or path, and that's cool. You know, I'm you know, you don't have to sign to me. I'm just a guy with a label that likes music and works with some people and doesn't work with others. It's all good.
Right. You know? That's great. Just before we go, is there anything that you, you'd want maybe a new artist to think about before they maybe even approach a label?
Write lots of songs and, you know, self-edit. You know, nothing's better than an artist is prolific in terms of songwriting and creating. And you create, you know, 30 things, probably 7 or 8 that are going to be really good. And if you only create 10, it might be only 2 or 3. So yes. Do what you do and do it a lot.
Yeah.
Write so much.
Quantity is job one.
Yeah, that is true. Well, I hear the band coming in, and that means that that's all the time we have here on Song Talk Radio. Mm-hmm. Special thanks for Jeff for stopping by. Jeff, how can people learn more about Linus Entertainment?
Well, I guess go to linusentertainment.com or truenorthrecords.com or stonyplainrecords.com. Our three main labels.
Awesome. And out there in listener land, we want to hear from you. So send us your comments on Twitter, Facebook, or Instagram to @SongTalkRadio, or send us an email at feedback@songtalk.ca. And if you're listening on the podcast stream, why not check out the YouTube channel for the live performances and full episodes now that we're all in these little boxes. And if you're on YouTube, you should subscribe, because that means you'll be famous. I guarantee it. Warning, not a real guarantee. Subscribe today to the Song Talk Radio podcast on your favorite podcast provider, and don't forget to sign up for the free newsletter at songtalk.ca. You can find the links to all the products, books, and web services we mentioned here on the show on the resources page. And wherever you are in the world, why don't you join us for the next Song Talk Meetup? It's free to join on meetup.com, and it's free to attend. Stop by the show for the link. And most of all, we'd like to thank you, the home listener. You can follow Neil at
neilmody.com.
And how about you, Michael?
Try Proudfoot420 on Instagram.
And you can get more information on me at philemery.ca. And stop by the website at songtalk.ca to browse past shows and find out how you can be a guest on the show. Stay safe, everyone, and keep on writing.
Hello. Good.
And that's it.